give us housing for 60 to 70 people, something like that. But in the meantime, we are proposing to do mini retreats. There are two large houses on the property, which you can sort of see in the, one of them is hidden there, but you can see one of them in the picture. And they're connected by a hallway, which is well locked at night, because there's ladies on one side and men on the other side. And it'll fit retreats of, right now it'll be 6 to 10 people each. And there's two kinds of retreats. What are we doing retreats there for? We have many, many days, many, many arguments, many, many things to decide. But basically the decision is this. That place is a meditation place. It's always for meditation. Godstow is the original name of the place. We are required by the contract to keep the original name. And it means in Tibetan, do you know? Lhasa. Okay. we decided to dedicate it for meditation. These classes are very good. You're getting already a lot of what a Geshe would be getting in the monastery. You have studied, if you've been here from the beginning, you've studied each one of the five great books of Buddhism to differing levels. And so philosophically or, you know, mentally, intellectually, you're just about where you should be, and that's good. I don't think you can meditate very well in New York City. You know, we do try. The greatest enemy of meditation is what? Sound. And aside from our own mental afflictions, we said that last week, last class. But we need to meditate. There's five great levels of spiritual realization in Buddhism called the five paths. And the movement between each path is done only in deep meditation. You cannot get to the five paths unless you're in deep meditation. And you have to be able to meditate deeply. So we really have been seeking a way that we could do meditation together, and that it's almost like your one arm is very, very strong. Your philosophical studies have been very good. You're very, very well-educated Buddhist. But the other arm, which is meditation, you can't really do very well unless you get an opportunity to do it in a very quiet place and a very good atmosphere and a very concentrated way. Really, you should be trying to be doing 1 month retreats and things like that. It takes about 9 days, I can tell you from experience, to bring your mind into a meditative state in retreat. We don't have that much time, and also we don't have the zoning yet. So we're going to start with mini retreats, just so you can get the taste of the proper way to meditate. And then as we get the zoning, we've already been offered, it seems, help to build meditation cabins there. Someone has already contacted us and offered to supply some cabins. So that will come, but this is sort of like to get ready and to start working on it, that we'll have weekend retreats there. And there'll be two kinds of retreats. They'll be limited to 10 people. The most people that can ever go up on a weekend will be 10 people. Can be any mix of men and women, but they must stay in separate places, in the separate buildings. And there'll be two sorts of meditation retreats. They'll always be devoted to meditation. There won't be any philosophical classes there. Devoted, the place will have the energy and the theme of going there to meditate. If you do a weekend meditation, say from Friday to Sunday, from Friday evening to Sunday afternoon, there'll be silence kept. You won't be talking. And then there's a pretty strict schedule of meditation. And then there's a pretty strict schedule of walking meditation. And there's a pretty strict schedule of work meditation of about 2 hours on Saturday, so that you start to get into the energy of the place. Okay. Each retreat will have a different theme. Every Sunday morning, you will take the one-day vows. Okay, this is a vows that you take. Those of you who've gone to Kopan, we researched all the great retreat places in the world. We consider Kopan to be the best. We rated IMS pretty high, Insight Meditation Society. And then we also visited some Shivananda organizations, because they do very good retreats there for the last 25 years or so. And we studied all of their setups, and we think it's important to do the one-day vows. You say you take those on Sunday morning, and you keep them until the next morning, Monday morning, and that kind of gives you something to take home with you. So you would be leaving Sunday afternoon, and you'd be taking your vows home with you to remember what you did on the weekend. So it'll be a structured retreat, meditation, heavy meditation. The place is extremely good for meditation. It's totally silent. There's 100 acres of forests and meadows for the walking meditation, which we are convincing the town is totally necessary for tax exemption. And beautiful lakes there, and just a beautiful housing there. The karma of the place is also very powerful. It was the previous owners were the founders of UNICEF. So there was a man who spent his whole life trying to help children who had been hurt in the war, and in the World War I and World War II. And he spent his whole adult life mostly working for free. His name was Maurice Pate, and he did not take a salary for many, many years. And he did it. That was his base for his. That's where he lived. And so the karma of the place is very sweet. The karma there is very powerful. He was offered the Nobel Prize. He turned it down. He said, give it to UNICEF instead. And it was eventually given to UNICEF. So the karma there is very sweet. It's a very powerful place. Very quiet. And it's also very close by. It takes about an hour, just over an hour by train. As soon as we got the property, they built a train station in the town. And this old lady said, I don't know, we've been trying 30 years and new Buddhists move in and they build a train station, you know. So there's a train station a few miles away. And you can go there from Grand Central. It takes about an hour and 15 minutes, I think. And it's like $8. And that's the spiel. So two kinds of retreats will go on there in the coming year. We have a little thing in the inside called prearranged retreats. And they will be limited to 10 people. So, and also, we'll try to make sure that everybody can get into one. You know, if we have too many people, then we'll try to share it. But we'll try to split it up so that everybody can get a chance to go. But those will be retreats on those specific subjects. And we had some training for the leaders of the retreats. There are 6 people now trained, and they will be leading the meditation retreats. So you can sort of pick the subject you like, or the teacher you like, or the weekend that you like. And you can speak to Michael Witt. Michael's the coordinator for all the retreats at Godstock. He lives in this area. He's very available during the day and the evening. And he'll be taking all the names, and he'll be scheduling people, and he'll be doing all the work of coordinating people. And that'll be the thing. So if you want to sign up for any of these retreats here, you would contact him. And it's on first come, first serve for now. If it gets to be too much of a problem, we were up at Insight Meditation Society. They have a waiting list of something like a year or something. Now they have a lottery system because too many people want to go. So right now it'll be first come, first serve. Maybe later we have to either go to a lottery or build new buildings there. Okay. The other neat idea that we came up with is that if you want to do your own retreat, you can organize a retreat that doesn't conflict with one of the dates here. And you can get... We're asking people to try to get 6 to 10 people together to do a retreat. And you can organize your own retreat. Now, there's some rules about organizing your own retreat. First rule is you have to use one of the certified teachers whose names are on this list for now. Later we'll certify other people, more people. That's mostly so we can assure that what goes on there is really Buddhism and stuff like that. You also have to, if you start your own retreat, organize your own retreat, you have to get one of these administrators on the bottom. Those are the people who are doing the grunt work. They are making sure the food crew is all put together, that the groceries have been bought, that people have brought their linens. You have to bring your own linens. We don't have any laundry service. And things like that. There are people who are in charge of the facility for that weekend. So if you decide to organize a retreat, right now those are the only people who are authorized to open the place and to set you up. So if you decide to do your own retreat, you have to find someone to lead it from this list. And then you have to find someone to be your... In Tibet, it's called Nyerpa. Nyerpa is the food guy, the guy with the keys, the guy who turns off the heat, the guy who turns on the heat, the guy who makes sure you cleaned up your bathroom, and stuff like that. So right now, you have to have one of those to organize the retreat. We had a lot of arguments about what to do financially. The place costs $800 a week, whether we do use it or not. When it was offered to us, because they went bankrupt, we said, could we just have like a few acres of it? And they said, take the whole thing or don't take anything. And so we had all these big meetings, and we decided that for the sake of the future, we would try to take it. And we also have a very kind sponsor who is sponsoring half of the, basically half of the cost for the next 9 years, something, 9 or 10 years. So we do have a sponsor for that. So what we're trying to do is recover half of the maintenance, which means the heat, the insurance, the taxes that we're trying to get out of, and things like that. We don't feel comfortable charging people to go there. So we made a very diabolical system. If 10 people decide to do a retreat there, that group, between themselves, has to come up with half of the maintenance cost. We figure $385. So it means if you're going to use the place for a three-day retreat, you ask your group to come up with $385. Now, the idea is you get Fran Perello or somebody with a good job to go. And they pay $350, and then the other 9 people pay $4. And that's the principle. And the idea is that inside of your group, you would try to encourage the people that have better incomes to pay more, and the people who don't, or right now they don't have a job, or, you know, trying to get their feet on the ground or something, young people in college, that they would pay less. But it works out to like $38 for 3 days. The whole thing up at IMS, not to criticize, I mean, they run at a loss, but it costs, if you count the transportation and everything else, it was about, I don't know, or was it, I don't know. The course was 120 for from Friday. So it was a 200 and something for food in the course, okay? By the way, that money doesn't include the food. The food is up to you. If your group wants to eat well, you know, eat well. If your group wants to have potato chips, they can have potato chips. That's up to you guys, okay? But that's the concept. You can, and that you can start. Michael has the calendar. One weekend a month is reserved for Sangha use, for the monks and nuns. One of the primary uses of the property and the primary reason that it was given to this organization was for building a monastery and a nunnery. So the monks and nuns are being kind enough to let you come up and help foot the bill for the place for retreats. So, I mean, eventually we planned that we would give 25 acres to a monastery, 25 acres for a nunnery, and then like 25 acres would go towards retreat cabins. I figured we could fit maybe 30 retreat cabins there on that. It's nice, it's big. Yeah.
What is the weekends?
Just what they say. we'll talk about it. And then the other area of the land, we're thinking to have translation activities, research activities, like that. About 45 minutes away is one of the best Tibetan libraries in the world, which is Dr. C.T. Shen's place. And he has pledged that we could use the place anytime we want. Free access to the library there. And he's also pledged that anytime Andy's ready to build the monastery, he has a fleet of heavy equipment, and he said we could just use it for free. So it's things I read in there. Somebody asked about the weak workings. They're called Zege. Zege means Zele Tumengewa. It's in the Abhidhamma Kosha, fourth chapter. And it means you get a special karma from taking care of temples, like the way Ken Rinpoche has taken care of Rashi Genpo Ling. If those of you who are aware, he pays almost all the grounds cost there himself. And he has planted all the trees there. We did all the sidewalks, we did all the fences, we did the driveway, we did the garage, we built his house. And all of it is called Zege. Zege means, it's a special karma that comes to you if you help build or work on a place which is a spiritual center, a monastery, nunnery, stupa, anything like that. And it's supposed to be, according to Abhidharma, some sort of extraordinary virtue, like Leon did it today. He fixed the shower on the second floor. Congratulations. No, that's a Zege. Zege means it's some kind of extraordinarily powerful karma. So they're scheduled two Zege work weekends. And that's just going to be work, and it's fun. You know, it's going to be just go up, help rebuild the fences there. There's beautiful white fences in there. Some of them are broken. Help clear away some of the trees that fall down from time to time. You know, help clean out the water. There's some two nice streams. There's a natural spring there. And we have to keep those clean. And just try to serve the place like that. And that's just a heavy-duty weekend. Fran Perella has promised that anyone who goes will have free food, you say? And generally, I think it'd be a lot of fun and a chance to get away from New York City. The air up there is really cool, and the place is extraordinary. Eventually, we have to build a temple, a main temple. We have to build a monastery. We have to build a nunnery and all your retreat cabins, so you can spend your old age there. In retreat. So we'll talk about it. I'm serious, okay? And you have to start doing long retreats. The natural progression of this course and of these classes is that at a certain point you start doing your long retreats, say a month each. And I would hope that everyone here could get up to the point where they're doing like two a year, 1 month retreats. And that's just the natural progression you have to do in your life. First you study. Then you start doing short retreats, and then you start doing longer retreats. And then all of this stuff will click, and all of those things will actually happen to you. All those things we're always describing that happen to you at certain stages. You must be meditating heavy duty. So now we finally have a chance to do that. Okay, that's my spiel. Did I forget anything, maybe? No?
Michael?
Yeah.
What about beyond the cost of covering the utilities, donating something to the property?
Oh, Stillwell says if $37 or whatever, that's minimum, okay? I mean, we're asking, if you go up there and you're a millionaire and you had a good time, then there'll be like in some box and you throw in another $500,000 or something. I mean, we're just trying to meet the maintenance cost, but I really don't like to do it. We have horrible debates about it. We will have to give the place back. We will lose the place by the contract if we can't keep it up to a certain standard. That's the contract that we have. We cannot, we have to meet the expenses. We cannot break up the property. We're not allowed to break up the property. Maybe they are tantric deities and they wanted to make sure that the monks have enough land 200 years from now. I don't know, but they will not allow us to make any income off the property. We have to keep it one piece, and we have to keep it up. So we're just trying to find a way to do that. I believe that it wouldn't be out of the question that in 10 or 20 years you would have 100 monks and nuns there, and then maybe 500, and then maybe 1,000. This is the idea. This is the goal. And then, 100 people in three-year retreats or something from New York City who are in their 60s and 70s. like that. Yeah, Michael.
Did you say the
word you used to create? Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
We already have some
volunteers. Oh, okay. The worker kids are free. You can get fed.
Are they limited to 10 also?
I think they're limited to 10 or not. Are they limited to 10? Yes. Yeah, we have to limit it because of the zoning right now.
Okay.
You are visitors.
People should send in these forms. And
also, one more thing. Like, if you're new here and you don't know five other people, that you could get together in a gang and go up together, then check this last thing here. The last thing on the form here is that, look, I don't know five other people. I would like to get in on one of these retreats that people organize. And if there's other people who are organizing a retreat and they only have six or seven people and they have three empty spaces left, please contact me. Because I don't know six other people in this group or something like that. You're welcome to do that. And anybody in this group can start a retreat. It's just totally up to you. Anyone in this room can go around, get five friends, five to nine friends, and organize your own retreat. The only rule in order to keep the place from being trashed is that you have to have one of the administrators there with you, and you have to have one of the teachers there who can keep you on the meditation schedule. And that's the only rule right now. Yeah?
What if we want to do it?
She asked what if you wanted to do a retreat on a subject that's not here. Well, that's the whole point. That's the whole idea. You pick your own subject also. We tried to list specialties of these people. But if you have anything else that you would like to organize a retreat about, you contact that teacher and you say, would you be willing to do a mandala retreat, like a whole weekend on mandala, meditating on mandala. And that's fine. That's fine. You can do that. Okay. And I think you should use your imagination, and you know, we were very addicted to the place. I mean, you stay there a day, you don't want to go home, and it's really beautiful, so you're welcome to go up. By the way, somebody asked, can you do it during the week? You can do it during the week, fine, no problem. You know, if you want to do a 5-day with six friends, that's also, you're welcome to do that. Michael Wick has to investigate the fact that there's a Sangha retreat and a work retreat on the same day that we didn't notice in September. But I hope it doesn't mean that the Sangha has to work. Okay, tonight I would like to introduce you to 20 new friends. They're called Ninyan. Oh, by the way, one more thing about Connecticut. People from every MSD center are welcome to organize retreats. Well, we're sending this out to everybody in an MSD center, wherever they are. And you're welcome to bring friends that you recommend, okay? So if you know somebody who's not in MSD and you think they'd like to come, you're welcome to bring them. But you're the one who's vouching for them. And if they take off their clothes and run around and stuff like that, we will, which has happened, we will not, you'll be responsible. And next time you want to bring somebody, we'll say, chief, ever that guy. So it's just sort of a system to prevent anything strange from happening. We are still new in that town. The mayor, I had a long talk with the mayor. He had a lot of strange concerns about us, and illegal concerns about us, and we don't want to make any waves, okay? There's a country club across the street that pays $20,000 to join it each year, and we have to watch it. So we're being a little bit strict about who goes up. Anyone in these classes is welcome. Anyone in any other MSTC center is welcome, and anyone that you vouch for. Right now, maybe later and we'll open it up. When we have a huge dormitory and all that. Okay, say Nyenyun.
Nyenyun.
Nyenyun. Nyenyun means, Nyewe Nyomo means secondary mental affliction. You met the big six. Now meet the next 20, okay? There are several explanations of why they're called Nyenyuns. Some people say because they're close to a big affliction. Some people say because they come from the big afflictions. I kind of like the second explanation. But they are secondary in the sense that, like, if you have desire, then that qualifies you for maybe six more mental afflictions, which are not quite so powerful. Okay, and that's the idea of a secondary mental affliction. I'm going to give you very quickly the 20. Okay, the homework says you have to name and describe any six of them on your homework and on your quiz. So you can sort of pick your favorites. yeah, good idea. Say troa.
Troa.
Troa. Troa. Troa means anger. Okay? That's why, by the way, it's not so great to translate the primary mental affliction as anger. Okay? That's what? What primary mental affliction does this stem from? Disliking things. Okay? And then this is sort of a natural progression of that. Alright? So it starts with not liking something, and then it's like, okay? This is real anger. This is like what happens when your boss criticizes you at work and stuff like that, okay? It's supposed to be the lead up to actually hurting somebody, okay? It inspires you to hurt somebody, okay? Say kunzin.
Kunzin.
Kunzin is a... It's hard to translate in English. It means keeping your anger over a longer period of time. Like troa is the first blow up. And then kunzin is where you're sort of... You sort of feel angry at the person for days or weeks or years, you know. I heard a very nice nun in Tucson. What's her name? Chutun. And she was describing how this phenomenon of someone says something to you that you don't like, you remember it for years, and they don't have any recollection of ever saying that to you, you know. But years later, you're still obsessing on this thing. And still mad at them, and they just were joking or something, and that was like 2 years ago, and the only one that remembers it is you, and that's kunzin. Okay, kunzin means I call it keeping anger or retaining anger. Okay, it's sort of like bearing a grudge. Okay, but it's not quite that. It's retaining anger over a period of time. Troa is the first 5 minutes or 10 minutes after the person has left, and you're still seething. And you still feel angry for like an hour or a day or a lifetime, that's kunzin. Okay. Say tsikpa.
Tsikpa.
Tsikpa. You guys know the word tsik? Not as word. Tsik means, literally it means to burn, something to burn. But this verb, this noun, tsikpa, this is like irritation. Okay, it's like starting to get hot. You know, someone's been bothering you, and you're starting to build up some kind of, your heart starts to beat faster. It's not anger yet. It's pre-anger, okay? Kunzin is post-anger. Tsikpa is pre-anger. And it's like, how do we translate it? Irritation. Okay? And its main function is to make you say something bad. You know, stupid. You know, but it's the feeling that leads up to that. It's the way you start to get... your heart starts to burn a little bit. It means irritation or starting to get irritated with this person. And its function, its job is done when you start to talk, when you start to say something to that person. Harsh. Okay? That's called sikpa. Say namse.
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 This is sometimes nabatsewa. Nabatsewa means, we translated it as malice. But what it means is the state of mind in which you're ready to hurt somebody. You know, it's a decision to hurt somebody. Okay. Either verbally or physically or whatever. But you're in your mind, you've decided to hurt somebody. Here comes my specialty. If anybody wants to lead a leader retreat, I can do this one. Say chakdo.
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 Chakdo means jealousy. And it's just that. I'll give you the definition in Tibetan. I mean, translated, okay? There's a nice translation by Janice's mother, Ani Chunila, in that Green Logic book, which you can get at the Three Jewels. It says, this is a part of anger, an inner disturbance of the mind, which out of a desire for gain and honor cannot bear the sight of another person's happiness. Okay. Definition of jealousy. Okay. Mainly, it's a disturbance of the mind. It wants people to pay attention to me. And it's unhappy about other people's good fortune, about their happiness. And it's a kind of anger. It's a form of anger. And again, no need to mention that it's totally hypocritical for a bodhisattva. I mean, you are hereby honorary bodhisattvas, okay? And it's just totally wrong. It's the opposite of bodhisattva mind, okay? It's bodhisattva is going to go to hell if necessary to make sure other people get what they want. And jealousy, someone else got what they wanted, and you're like, can't stand it, you know? And it's crazy. It's mental affliction and mental illness, and all in one, you know? It's like, it's crazy to not want someone else to be happy, okay? Or to want, to wish that it didn't happen to them, okay? And it's very common in Dharma centers. You have to be careful, okay? Also, the mental afflictions cannot stand this kind of activity. The demons that live in the world, and they do live in the world, cannot bear this kind of thing going on. That's why it's so rare, you know? There's not a lot of Bodhisattva Charvatara classes going on tonight in New York City. Although there's, you know, so many million people here. They can't stand it. They get very, very upset about it. So what they would like the most is if these Dharma brothers and sisters could somehow split up from each other or get jealous of each other or like that. That would please them more than anything. So just to spit at them, let's not have any jealousy. Okay? And just be careful. It grows very easy. It stays in your mind. And it's very, very sick for a person who says they're on the Bodhisattva track. And I confess to it and I admit it to everyone here. You know, I have it all the time and it's bad. We have to try to stomp it out before it ever gets a foothold among these minds here, okay? So keep it in mind, okay? All right, number six. Say, gyu.
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 This is not the gyu with the ra head letter, which means cause. And this is not the gyu that's gyuma, which means maya, meaning illusion. And it's also not the gyu with the saha letter that means large intestines, okay? this is the gyu that means falsity or insincerity in the sense that you will not admit you're false, okay? It's some kind of not being straight with yourself, not being sincere, and trying to not admit that you have anything wrong with you. And what happens if you have gyu is that no one can teach you anything. Okay? Like if you do not admit to yourself that you have any shortcomings or that you have anything to learn, then no one can teach you anything. So gyu has a special function of blocking you from hearing it when you go to a teaching because you don't think it applies to you. Nothing. I don't have that problem. That's gyu, okay?
Denial.
Denial would be, that's probably a nice way to put it. Okay. Say, yoa.
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 Yoa means to shake like that, like an earthquake is called sayom, they're related. Yoa means to, I'm trying to think of a way. It's to put on good qualities that you don't have. Okay, what do you want to call it? I don't know. It's like pretending to be very holy when you're not. Pretense is good. By the way, this is very hard to translate. Some of them don't have good English words. But yoa means you want other people to honor you. You want other people to respect you. So you try to pretend that you have like a kind of a hypocrite. That you try to pretend that you have some qualities that you don't have. There's a story about the guy who... He wasn't doing any mandala offerings or something. No, his altar was a big mess. And then he had some important sponsors coming. So he spent a lot of time and he fixed up his altar really nice. And then he realized that he had yoa. So he took a big pile of dirt and he threw it all over the altar just before the sponsors got there. And that was an honest act. And then some lama was teaching in another part of Tibet and he said, somebody just did something very virtuous, you know. He had ESP and he could see, and he said, somebody just admitted that their own hypocrisy, and it's a great spiritual event has just happened, you know. It's really cool.
Eminence front be good for yoga.
Say again?
Eminence front, like, put on.
Yeah, put on. Say Mota.
Mota.
Never.
Never.
Mota.
Mota.
Never.
Never.
I mean, the ancient meaning of this is no means your face, and sa means to be hot, and it means to blush. And mota, like if you're debating somebody at Sarah, and they say something stupid, you just go like that. Like, you should be ashamed for saying such a stupid thing. Like, you're debating them, and you don't clap your hands or anything, you just go, you know, like that. So lota means shame. Lota mema means a lack of shame. Shame here means the opposite of this, by the way, lota yupa, is that you are ashamed to do a bad deed because you yourself would be embarrassed to yourself. It's like some kind of self-esteem thing. Like, this is not worthy of me. I'm a Buddhist. I'm a monk. I shouldn't be doing this thing. And you stop. You hold yourself back. That's lotsa. Lotsa meba is the opposite. You know, like you don't have that quality. You don't hold yourself back. And this refers to shame in your own. In the privacy of your own room. Okay, lotsa is functioning internally, and no one else can see it. It means that in your own room, or you know, somewhere where there's some money there, and if you stole it, nobody would ever know. Lotsa is what keeps you from stealing it. Lotsa is what keeps you from doing a bad deed, even if no one else will ever know. That's lotsa meva. So it's important to understand that. This mental affliction is the lack of that. Okay? This mental affliction is doing bad deeds in private. Okay? And that's lotsa meva. Say, tel mepa.
Tel mepa.
Tel mepa.
Tel mepa.
We can shorten it to tell me. That's more common. Okay? Cut that. The one that we always use in the monastery is tell me. Okay? Tell me means the same state of mind. It's the opposite of tell you. Tell you, the opposite of this, is I won't do this bad deed because it will have certain repercussions on other people. It will hurt other people. Okay? That's tell you. The opposite of this is avoiding a bad deed. When you're just about to do something wrong, you hold back because you're afraid of how it will impact on other people. And you say, such and such a person will get hurt, or such and such a person will lose faith in Buddhism if they see me doing this. Okay? And that's chalyo. This is the opposite. Okay? This one says, I don't care what other people think. Okay? I'm going to go ahead and do what I want to do. We've translated it as lack of consideration, just because, I mean, considering others, the effect on others, is chal, not to consider the effect on others is chal mepa, okay, chal me. According to the Abhidharma Kosha system, which is not the system that I'm using for this presentation, the last two mental afflictions are present in every case of non-virtue. You know, anytime you do something wrong, you have one of these last two there, to some extent. You don't have the self-esteem, spiritual self-esteem, to avoid this for your own purposes, and you don't have the consideration of what it might do to how it might impact other people either. And that's the Abhidharma system says that. Yeah. I think it should be rather conscious. You know, Jetsam Kapa gets into that in his Bodhisattva Dao commentary, and it should be rather conscious. It means some kind of consideration. And chal yu means to have that consideration. I have never seen it in other applications. There are similar words that mean tax, same sound, or obligation. Okay. They may be related or maybe not, I don't know. Okay, say chaba.
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 Chaba is hiding your faults. Remember, the other one was affecting spiritual qualities that you don't have, and this one is hiding the bad qualities that you do have. It's especially important in the Vinaya. If a monk breaks even a minor vow, and if we have chava, if we try to hide it from the other monks, then it's much more serious. If we admit it quickly, then the karma is much less, and the vinaya consequence is much less. So it's very important to... Time is a factor with chava, okay? The longer you hide something, the karma exponentially builds. And the quicker you admit it to someone, the better. Okay. So if you have friends in California and you do a bad deed at night, you know, call them immediately. They're like 3 hours behind, you know. And don't wait till the next morning. The karma is much more powerful by the next morning. Okay. It's very important to admit the things you do and not to hide them. Okay. And sooner or later, I mean, it comes out anyway. I mean, and people are like dogs. They can smell. You know, the people around you, they know your... They look at your eyes for 30 seconds, where your eyes go. And they know you. You know, people know other people. They sense other people. The way... We used to have this really great dog called Rusty that I know you miss. And if a person walked in the door who didn't like dogs, he would just bite them right away. I mean, they have this kind of instinct. And people are the same, you know. You can try to hide your bad qualities. Believe me, everybody knows. Just admit it and clean up your act. You know, it's much easier to admit it and clean up your act than to continue the very difficult task of hiding it, you know. And sooner or later it comes out anyway. So better just not to have anything to hide. And if you have a bad quality that you can't stop, then just admit it to other people and work on it. You know, and I mean, a Buddha should just be an open book, you know, and just admit everything about yourself and fix it. But it's this act of hiding it then creates some kind of denial in yourself, and then you don't fix it. You know, you stop fixing things. So don't have chubba. Chubba means people shouldn't know that I have this particular bad quality. You know? Yeah. He has to do between that and number six. The definition of number six means out of an attachment to gain and honor, and its primary function is to prevent you from getting spiritual instruction. Okay? It's to shut you off from spiritual instruction. It's some kind of dishonesty. Okay? And chaga is more like a Watergate state of mind. It wants to cover up. It wants to do a cover up. Okay.
But then you always say all the time.
Yeah, then it gets into guilt.
Dilma says,
it's true.
Your friends will get bored if you're always confessing your jealousy in front of classes and stuff. It does. I mean, but yeah, he says, think about Atisha. Atisha used to carry around a little stupa, and every time he had a bad thought, he would put it down, prostrate to it, and confess. And there's all these stories, Master Atisha, sorry. And there's all these stories of him being on the road, you know, they're riding horses, and he would say, stop, everybody has to stop, you know. They stop their horses, and he'd get down, take his stupa, you know, prostrate, and confess that he just had a bad thought. And they couldn't get to where they're going all the time, because he kept stopping, you know. And I guess if Master Atisha can do it, Lord Atisha. then we can do it. Joel J., right? I don't know. Within reason. I mean, by the way, if it stops having an effect, meaning, you know, like Rinpoche, when I used to do my non-chapas, would say, okay, you know, I'm tired of hearing that one. Can you just fix it, you know? it's a lot easier to fix it, okay? But if you can't fix it, it's still better to keep telling somebody. And if you break a bodhisattva vow, you know the procedure, right? Some of them have to be confessed in front of certain numbers of your friends. And they don't even have to be people with bodhisattva vows. They just have to be someone who understands about the bodhisattva vows. When you break the secondary vows, you must go to a certain number of other people and admit what you did immediately. you know. So I have, like, telephone friends, really, all over the country, and we call each other. And when we break one, we call each other, and we say, okay, I broke that one, you know. If you break a primary bodhisattva vow, what? If you break it in a certain, totally, then you have to take it over again.
Okay.
Say serna.
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 Serna means, I don't know if there's a good word in, I mean, there's a lot of colloquial words. Cheap, stingy, okay. Doesn't want to give anything. Wants to keep everything. Okay. Tight-fisted, parsimonious. Okay. Say gyatpa.
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 You wouldn't have any mental afflictions. Okay. For example, pride. Gyatpa in colloquial Tibetan means fat, you know, chubby. As a mental affliction, it means focusing on your own temporary good qualities and being stuck up about them. Okay? Like, I'm very beautiful, or I'm very strong, or I'm very smart, or I'm very spiritual. You know, and that's gyatpa. Okay, it's like kind of stuck up.
Puffed
it's
up.
Puffed up. Yeah, yeah.
The Bible,
puffed up. That's gyatpa. Okay, all right. Say madepa.
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 Depa means faith. Madepa means lack of faith, not feeling faith. Okay. And obviously about objects towards which you should feel faith, like, you know, say the Dalai Lama, okay? And madepa is almost a kind of laziness or something, where you just, like, you don't feel that admiration that you should feel. You feel, it's sort of like a spiritual admiration laziness or something like that, okay? Where you're just like, oh, he's just a normal guy, who cares, you know? Okay. That's madepa. How many mental afflictions total now?
26.
26. Okay. And if we wanted to spend the time, how many? 84,000 variations, okay? These are just the top 26. 84,000 variants. Say Lelo.
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 Lelo sounds like Lelo. And it means laziness, okay? Laying low. This will probably be one of the six you can put on your homework.
Laziness.
Spiritual laziness, specifically. Its opposite is tsundru, and Shantideva defines it as tsungkangela trowa o, which means a lack of joy in doing goodness. That's the worst kind of laziness. But lounging around your house and wasting your holy lifetime is also lelo. Okay. So even normal laziness is also lelo. The ultimate lelo is to not take joy in spiritual things. Say bhagmepa. Bhagmepa. Bhagmepa means like some kind of carelessness, not being careful in your spiritual life. Okay. They say the best way to get bhagmepa is to have a few beers. Okay? They say that, you know. So if you want to know what bhagmepa is, it's what you... It's sort of like good inhibition or something like that. Okay? And if you lose it when you get drunk or... And then you're more likely to do something bad. Okay? That's bhagmepa.
Does bhagmepa mean having it or losing it?
This means not having it. Not being careful. Not being spiritually mindful. Okay. Say jenge.
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 Jenge is forgetting yourself or losing focus. Okay. In meditation, when you study the art of meditation, in ACI course number 3. Jenge is in there as one of the faults of meditation. And it's where the object just, you lose the object. Totally. You know, forget about it being clear or not clear or intermittent or not intermittent. Your mind is just totally onto something else. And that's jenge. It's just you just forget yourself completely. And it can function, it can be all during the day. You know, like you decide, I did my four forces of purification this morning, and I will not yell at my boss the whole day. And that's my restraint, you know. And then you just forget it. And you yell all day long, you know, and you get home and you say, oh yeah, I was going to do that, you know, and that's Jenga. Jenga is just totally forgetting some virtuous thing that you decided you were going to do. Okay? And also in meditation, to just totally lose the object. And, you know, it's not like you're just distracted slightly, you just lost it altogether. You don't even know what you're meditating about. Okay? It happens to me all the time. Say Sheshin.
Sheshin.
Mayimba.
Mayimba.
Sheshin.
Sheshin.
Mayimba.
Mayimba.
Sheshin means some kind of awareness, self-awareness. Mayimba means not being that way. In meditation, this is the state of mind which is acting as the alarm. Okay? Like, if the mind starts to wander, this state of mind is watching the mind. There's a state of, you're meditating, here's the mind which is meditating, and then Sheshin is over here watching, you know, like a watchdog. You can call it watchdog mind. Sheshin Mayimba is losing watchdog mind. And whenever this mind starts to wander, this mind goes, hey, he's starting to wander, you know. And then Trenpa comes, recollection, and says, get back here. And then Sheshin stands up again and watches, you know. And then the mind starts to get dull, and then Sheshin says, hey, something's going on, and then recollection brings it back up. It's two separate mental functions. Sheshin is the watchdog. It's the red flag. Okay? It goes off. Sheshin Mayimba means you don't have any red flags going off in your mind. You do whatever you want all day long, you know, and there's no, nobody's raising the alarm. There's no Paul Revere, you know, saying, hey, wait a minute, something's going on here in this mind. You know, the enemy is winning. And when you get Sheshin Mayimba means you're just not having that. He said awareness. It's pretty close to awareness.
Guarding awareness.
Guarding awareness. That's not bad.
Say mukpa.
Mukpa.
Mukpa. Mukpa is literally the Tibetan word for fog. And it means a dullness of the body or mind. Like if you had a big meal and you didn't have enough sleep the night before, you know, you have a big lunch or something. That's mukpa. And that state of mind is mukpa. And it's just some kind of stupid, dull, low-level, dull state of mind. Dullness, mental dullness, something like that. Foggy mind, okay? And it's torpor, okay? It's like, it's self-afflicted, you know? It's self, you did it to yourself. I mean, you shouldn't have stayed out so late. You shouldn't have eaten so much. And then you get the reward for it, you know? You're just like, you know, and it's like when you're at work around 2 o'clock, if it's like my office, okay? That's called mukpa. It tends to promote the other mental afflictions. If you allow yourself, because of your appetite, or because of other reasons, to get into mukpa, you're setting yourself up for other mental afflictions. You know, it's like being tired and dull. And then an opportunity comes along to do something wrong or to think some anger or something. And mukpa is a very fertile field for those other mental afflictions. Okay?
Say namyang.
Namyang.
Namyang is distraction, mental distraction. Like your mind is being distracted to a pleasant object.
What do you call when you always, like, forget your keys?
I don't think that's a mental affliction. She asked about forgetting your keys.
You know, how you always, like, forgetful about certain things, you know? I kind of block.
I don't think forgetting your keys is a mental affliction, okay?
Well, what about misplaced?
It's you know, the jenge, the mental function of jenge has to be aimed at a virtuous object.
Okay.
Like you forget that you weren't going to yell at your boss today, or you forget the object which you're meditating on, or something like that. Yeah. That would be that last one is pretty good, yeah. But yeah, that's pretty good. Both physical and mental, it's important to say. Okay. Did you have a question?
The difference between 16 and 17.
I was afraid you were going to ask me that. In meditation, jenge is losing the object completely. OK? Okay. And it's a very low, it happens at very low levels of the meditational curve. You know, as you get better in meditating, you rarely have jhengye. Early on in your meditational career, you get a lot of jhengye. It's just like you just wake up for a minute and you say, I forgot totally what I was meditating about. You know, I don't even remember what I was meditating about. It's at a very initial point in your meditation career. Some people, that initial point lasts 20 years. But you get to a pretty decent level of meditation, it doesn't happen anymore. Sheshin Mayimba is where the guarding mind, which goes all the way up to Buddhahood, you know, it's there all the way up to Buddhahood. It's a state of mind which is watching the mind and raising the alarm. Like a Buddha, as you're progressing along the path pretty high, you would never have jhengye again. I mean, especially in meditation. You would never forget totally what you were meditating about. It wouldn't be that bad. But Sheshin Mayimba, Sheshin is something that you have to have all the way up. I mean, all the way up to Buddhahood or close to, you could have periods where your mind is not calling the alarm and not saying, hey, wait a minute, you were supposed to be meditating, you know. Or, you know, wait a minute, something's going on here. There's a mental affliction coming in. You know, close the door. You know, wake up. You know, it's the wake-up call. Okay. And that's the difference between those two. Okay. So Namyang number 19 is distraction towards a pleasant object. And it's a kind of desire. It comes from that main mental affliction of wanting things ignorantly. Okay. Say gopa. Gopa. Gopa is also during meditation, but it refers to being unable to keep your mind one pointed. Sometimes it's translated as scattering. Okay. And you find yourself unable to keep your mind on a single thought or a single point. And I think it must be very typical in Manhattan, you know. And even with your personal life, with my personal life, you know, having too many projects going on in a macro way, being unable to focus on things. In a meditational way, it's going off, your mind going off to other subjects. By the way, gopa can even be towards a virtuous object. Okay, like you can be trying to focus on a Buddha image, and then start thinking about the charity you're going to perform at 2:00 today. That's gopa, and it's considered a bad deed. You know, once you've decided to focus on a single virtuous object, it's considered gopa to get distracted by thinking about all the good things you're going to do today. Okay, because the point of the meditation was to keep your mind on one virtuous object. Okay? Does that mean you can't do many virtuous things at once? As you progress along Bodhisattva path, you are encouraged to become multifaceted. I mean, Chenrezig has 1,000, the meaning of the 1,000 arms is that as you progress higher, you should be able to juggle more virtuous balls, and that's no problem. That becomes a good deed. Those of you who have a Dakye practice, Rinpoche asked Trijan Rinpoche 25 years ago, how can I be one-pointed about this thing which has 40,000 different visualizations in it? And Trijan Rinpoche said, it's one practice. It's one movie going on, you know. And you focus on it from beginning to end, and that's a one object. You know, that's one-pointedness. So, I mean, a bodhisattva, once you get up to that kind of strength spiritually, you can have many objects of focus because it's one spiritual life. You know, it's all part of one big network of virtue that you're doing, and it's all one-pointed virtue. So there comes a point where it says, as you progress further, you can get busier, and it's okay as long as you're focusing single-pointedly on it. Okay? Last point, then we'll take a break. There's a verse in Master Shantideva where he says, you should... love the path, you know, get attached to the methods you learn to fight your mental afflictions. And also, please be sure to develop hatred for your mental afflictions. And the verse is very cool. You won't get the verse tonight because we couldn't finish it. We considered doing an all-nighter and There's too many. I mean, we tried and we couldn't finish, so next week. But anyway, it's a very beautiful verse. He says, I want all of you to go out and try to develop attachment and hatred, okay? Attachment for what?
Two ways of removing it, right?
For punching out the mental afflictions. Hatred for what? For this great enemy that caused you all your mental and physical suffering. And then Gyaltsep Jay gets into this big debate. He says, are these mental afflictions or not? You know, is loving or being attached to the path and the war against the mental afflictions, is that a mental affliction itself? And is it a mental affliction to hate your hatred or to hate your own anger? And he gets into this big debate because, unfortunately, there's an early Sanskrit commentary that says, then later, these two mental afflictions or these two ideas will be finished. You know, there's a later Sanskrit commentary that says, these two mental, he doesn't say exactly mental afflictions, but he says, these two attitudes will be finished. So many commentators have taken it to mean that they are mental afflictions and that, okay, you put up with them for a while and then later you'll overcome them. The two mental afflictions of enjoying the war, loving to fight the mental afflictions, and being spitting on the mental afflictions and hating them, you know. And Gyaltsep Jay says, that's not the point at all. He says, if you read the verse carefully, and if you know Tibetan, you can read it more carefully. It says, Matopa, which means, these are not mental afflictions. Okay, what that commentary means is, once you've punched out the mental afflictions, you know, once you've knocked them out, well then you won't have to do those two things. You won't have to have a love for that war anymore, and you won't have to have this hatred for these guys as they exist in your mind, because they won't exist in your mind at that point. So then you will lose those two attitudes. But it doesn't mean that they are mental afflictions. So what he's saying is, it's fine to love Buddhism and to love the war, love making war on the mental afflictions. And then he's saying, it's fine to spit on your mental afflictions. You know, every time you get jealous, you should take great joy in being pissed off at your own jealousy. You know, very good, very appropriate. Get angry at your jealousy, he says. And very, very appropriate for Buddhists. Once you've kicked them out of your mind, then you won't have to do that anymore. Okay, and that's the way he says it. We're going to take a break, and then when we get back, we're going to talk about the possibility of kicking the mental afflictions out of your mind completely. You know, exactly how does that happen? Is it possible to beat this enemy in such a way that he never comes back? Okay.
It's just the ideal of a bodhisattva. I swear to think like a bodhisattva. You know, I swear to try to get to a point where I would give the rest of my life for other beings and to help them reach enlightenment. You know, I'll get there first, and on the way I'll help them, and when I get there I'll really help them. And that's all you're doing, you know. It's not like you don't have to cut your arm open or anything like that, okay? That comes later. No. Okay, we'll try to go fast. And Shantideva, Master Shantideva, gets into this long part next where he talks about, is it possible to beat the mental afflictions? You know, like, what kind of war is this going to be? Is this going to be like a normal war? Or not, you know. Are we going to beat Germany and then 20 years later they build up again and we have to fight them again? You know, is that the kind of war it is, or what kind of war is it? And he discusses the kind of... Sorry, Yulia. My grandma was there. But is this the kind of war where they're going to go back and regroup and then build up their strength again? And or is it possible? Is it even theoretically possible to wipe out the mental afflictions permanently? And then Master Shantideva gets into this verse, which is very sweet, and he says, if you think about it, all the mental afflictions come from what? Ignorance, which is the tendency to see things as
self-existent,
which is a mistaken state of mind. Okay? It's a mistaken state of mind. It's a misperception. It's a misunderstanding. It's focusing on the world in a way which is unreal. If the world is not that way, and ignorance thinks it is that way. So all of the bad thoughts that you have, the 26 that we've done, the 84,000 that we don't have time to do, they're all based on one mental function, which is misunderstanding your world, you know, misinterpreting your world. And because of that, says Master Shantideva, it is possible to wipe out the mental afflictions permanently. Okay, and once you cut the root, then you wouldn't have to worry about them anymore. So it's not like you're going to be fighting, and then you control your anger, and then you don't watch it for a couple of weeks and it starts to come back, like a bad weed or something like that. Mental afflictions are not like that. If you can destroy them from the root, which means if you can understand emptiness, you can reach a point where they will not exist anymore and they will not come back. They cannot come back because they must be based, if you were in Massachusetts, they must be based, the rawest forms of liking and disliking, which are the rawest forms of mental affliction, are themselves predicated on misunderstanding the world. You know, if you didn't misunderstand the world, you couldn't get those mental afflictions. So, therefore, it is possible to destroy them forever, and they will not come back. Okay, that's very cool. Hector, did you have? In the next verse, Master Shantideva discusses the seeds for seeing things that way, which we talked about up in Massachusetts also. Really, out of six stages of mental afflictions growing, the first stage is what? Do you remember? Pachana Nepa. It's ignorance in the seed form as you go into your next life. It's the ignorance you carry, it's the seeds for ignorance that you carry into your next life. And then even in the womb they start to grow. So you're right, yeah. The ultimate point is that you have to be able to remove the seeds also. And that's true. At 8 bodhisattva level or going into nirvana on a Hinayana track, you remove the seeds for mental affliction. You can't have them anymore. You can't have the seeds for ignorance. You cannot have the seeds anymore for thinking things are self-existent. And all mental affliction depends on that. And if that were not in your mind, then you could say that mental affliction will be removed permanently. He gets into a really sweet verse after that that says, well, is there someplace they could like hide out? Okay, they don't go back home and get strong again, but let's say, could they go to a third country and hang out and hide for a while? Is there any place else that the mental afflictions could go if you cut their home base in your consciousness? If you cut their home base, which is your ignorance, well, could they hang out in some other part of your being and then get back at you later somehow? So just... Master Shantideva goes through three possibilities. He says, let's see, where else would they hide out, you know? And he makes a list. Three alternative hideouts for the mental afflictions enemies after you've kicked their rear ends, okay? Say, Suksop, Yula, Mine. Suksop, Yula, Mine. The critical word here is yul, which sometimes means country, but here means object of your perceptions. Okay, what's the yul of the eye consciousness? Colors and shapes. What's the yul of the ear consciousness?
Sounds.
Okay, so is it possible for the mental afflictions, if you cut their home base in your mind, could they like park in the objects for a while, and then come back and get at you later? I mean, Master Shantideva is going through all the possibilities. You know, could they go out into colors and shapes? Could they go out into Tony Braxton's latest song and hide there, and then come back later and get you? You know, so he discusses that. He actually gets into it. Is it possible for the mental affliction tendencies to park in the external objects of your senses and your mind, and then come back and get you later? And he says, no, it's not possible. Why? Well, he asks the following question. Can arhats see colors and shapes? So, do arhats get mental afflictions?
No.
No. Okay? So if mental affliction were something that by nature was inherent in the world, you know, if it's some problem with the world that we have anger, you know, if the problem is not in our mind but it's in the world, then anybody who lived in the world and who saw New York City would get mental afflictions. But it's not true. People can reach nirvana, people can go to Manhattan, they can look at the Empire State Building and not get mental afflictions. So the mental affliction tendencies do not lie in the outer objects of our senses. They cannot hide out there, he says. Okay. They minay means they do not stay. I like to say they don't park. And there's in the longer form it says by nature. In the Yule, in the objects of visual forms and the rest. Okay? They don't stay in your outer world. They can't. If they could, then arhats would get mental afflictions. Say, miksok, wangbola, mine. Okay, what are all the possibilities for mental afflictions to hang out at? If they're not in your mind, if you're not in their consciousness, well, maybe they're in the objects of your consciousness, meaning the colors, the shapes, the sounds of the world. But if they hang out there, then arhats would also get mental affliction. Well, what about if they hang out in the sense powers themselves, in the sense organs? You know, what if they could go and hide in your visual optic nerve, okay, what we call the sense powers in Buddhist philosophy? What if they could stay in your ear, you know, in the power of hearing or in the power of touch? By the way, if you eliminate the mind and the sense power and the objects, there ain't no place else for them to go. And then you can say with finality, they're dead. I mean, if you get them out of your mind, they cannot stay even in some latent state in other places of your being. Okay? And this says, mik means the eye, sok means etc. Wangbo la means those sense powers. Minay means they don't stay there. Okay? They cannot stay there. Because everybody knows that even a person who is experiencing emptiness can still have a eyeball, even though they cannot have a mental affliction. So it can't be that the mental afflictions are hanging out in your eye power. Okay, you can have an eye power, you can be concentrating on emptiness, and you cannot have a mental affliction. So they cannot be staying in the eye power. Okay. What he's trying to say is, these are for people who have studied Abhidharma, okay? First chapter, Abhidharma Kosha. And he's trying to say, look, you can divide the world into the objects we see, into the mind that sees them, and into the eye which allows the mind to see the objects. And mental afflictions, if you can kick them out of the mind by understanding emptiness, they can't go park in the eye, and they can't go park in the outer world. They're gone. There's no base for them to come back to. They're gone and they have no place to build up their strength again, and to get reinforcements, and to come back and attack you again. He's still talking about a war, you know. If you kick them out of this one perimeter called your skull, you know, if you can get them out of your mind, there's no place else they can go. They have to be permanently destroyed. Okay? They cannot regroup and come back. Impossible. Say, parla.
Parla.
Mine.
Mine.
Parla.
Parla.
Mine.
Mine.
Parla mine is very simple. What's a pardo? In between being, right? Bardo. Okay? Parla means in the middle. Parla mine means there's no place else for them to go. There's no other, what do you call it, option. Number three means there's no other option. If they're not in the outer world that you're experiencing, if they're not in your consciousnesses, and if they're not in your sense powers, well, there ain't no place else for them to be. And they're gone. So he's trying to prove that you can defeat them permanently. And you're supposed to get happy. You're supposed to say, this is not like other enemies that if you sort of beat them for a while, then they rise up again. Not like that. Did you have a question?
Yeah. What
is Alzheimer's if Alzheimer's? So?
Well,
but he doesn't get a mental affliction. Wouldn't happen, I think, at that point that he could get Alzheimer's. Just karmically. Okay, I doubt it. Or he would be the first Alzheimer patient not to get violent. Okay. Seriously. Okay. By the way, I repeat, it is possible for an arhat to have a horrible death. But that they'd never be upset about it, never get angry, never feel any kind of hatred for anybody, nothing like that. Okay? I was afraid you'd ask me that, and I was amazed that no one mentioned it, and I was hoping to get away with it.
What is the question?
She said, when you said that people... I said, if you noticed, I only said perceived emptiness, okay? I was fudging it. If you're focusing on emptiness, it's impossible to have a mental affliction, period. But at that time, you can still have an eye power, and it can be even be active. So I'll say, I'll take a shot. It doesn't say clearly in the text. But I would say, direct perception of emptiness is obviously you couldn't have a mental affliction. But because you can't have any relative thought at that time, period. You cannot have an emotion at that time. It's impossible. But let's even say that if you understand the emptiness of an object even fairly well intellectually, for that millisecond that you're having that pure understanding, it's totally impossible to have a mental affliction at that time. Okay? You cannot understand an object's emptiness, even intellectually, clearly. We say clearly is a big thing in the scripture. Clearly. And then still have a mental affliction at the same time. Totally impossible. So you can be looking at that wall, understanding its emptiness, and it would be impossible during that 10 seconds, okay, to have a mental affliction about the wall. It's impossible. And that's what he's talking about. Okay. Two things and then we'll stop. Almost on time. We have reached the end of the war of the mental afflictions. We're cruising through the Bodhisattva Charitamrita at about 10 times normal speed, okay? Rinpoche took, I think, 8 or 9 years to teach it. We're trying to do it in a year, which is difficult. But you are getting the main... You're getting all the main stuff, and I can't see, you know... I'm not sure we'll have an opportunity to do it longer than that, so... We have to kind of move at a certain pace. That takes us to the six perfections. Okay, we have just reached the six perfections, or start to discuss them. Okay, we're going to start to discuss the six activities of Bodhisattva. We assume you already did the ceremony next week. Okay, and now you decided you want to get into acting like a Bodhisattva. They have mainly six main activities of a Bodhisattva. Okay, and that is, sorry. Say parutu.
Parutu.
Chimba.
Chimba.
Parutu.
Parutu.
Chimba.
Chimba.
Parutu chimba means paru means the other side, the far side. Like if you're standing on the east bank, the west bank is the paru. Okay. Chimba means went. Went there. Past tense. Went. Tu means there. To there. So parutu chimba means went to the other side, and it's translated as perfection, and that's a good perfection. That's a good translation. It's about one of the few ones that I agree with, okay? And it means perfection. Okay? In Sanskrit, other side is para. The locative is param. And itta is the past tense of go. And so param itta or paramita. Okay? Okay? Perfection. And there are six. Why do they call them perfection? I mean, everybody talks about the six perfections. Bodhisattva, the life of Bodhisattva is made up of six perfections. Why are they called perfections?
They make you perfect.
Probably when you use your old karmic merit. When you're a Buddha, they're perfected.
Sykes says, when you're a Buddha, they're perfected. That happens to be perfect answer. Perfection answer, okay? That's exactly right, okay? When you reach Buddhahood, they are perfection. But these are talking about activities for people like us who are not Buddhas yet. So why are they called perfections for us? Marcella said because she was in California, she cheated. Okay, just kidding. Because they get you to perfection. Okay, and that's paro to chin, che. Say paro to chin, che. Paro to Chinche. Really, you're doing six Paroto Chinches. You're not doing six Paroto Chimbas. Okay? Paroto Chinche means gets you to perfection. Takes you to perfection. You are, if you're not a Buddha already, then you're practicing the six gettings you to perfection. Getting to perfections? Anyway, they're Paroto Chinches. Okay? When you get to be a Buddha, they're Paramitachimbas. I'm gonna write them down very fast, okay? Six of them. Alright? And then we'll be done. Mostly. Six activities of the Bodhisattva. If you want this world to change before your very eyes, do these six. Okay. Say Jimba.
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 Jimba means giving. Okay. Some people call it charity. I think charity is like goodwill and Salvation Army, and you know, it's giving. Giving money, giving food, giving houses, giving dharma, giving protection. All those kinds of givings. Okay, Jimba. That's Jimba's name. And anytime you need an orange, he'll give you. Say, Tsultum?
Tsultum.
Tsultum means, I like to call it an ethical way of life. Okay? An ethical way of life. Keeping your vows. Okay? All the way from not committing the 10 non-virtues up to the hundreds of secret vows you might have. Okay? That you don't even know about. Okay. People call it morality. Morality reminds me of Billy Graham, and I just prefer to call it an ethical way of life. I don't know. Nothing against Billy Graham. He's a great man. But, okay.
Ethics okay.
Ethics is probably okay. Say sopa.
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 People translate it as patience. I don't like it much because patience to me means being able to sit in a doctor's office or something. It's not getting angry when the time is right. I like to translate as not getting angry. Patience is okay. Not getting mad. Maybe we don't have a word in English. I don't know. Say tsundru.
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 Tsundru
is translated in all sorts of ways. Fortitude, effort, energy. I like to call it joyful effort. It's defined as tsungang gela dro omish. You get off on doing good things. You get charged out of doing good things. It's the definition of it. Joy about doing good things. Say samten.
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 Ability to concentrate. Concentration. You can also translate it as meditation. Say shirab.
Shirab.
Shirab is wisdom. Okay, understanding the ultimate nature of things. Understanding emptiness. Understanding karma. Things like that. Okay, shirab. Wisdom. Those are the names of the six perfections. Right? We will spend the rest of the year on these six perfections. All right? The next two courses and the rest of this course are going to be devoted to that. These are the only things which can give you the karmic energy to reach your own paradise, in this life especially. Okay? Must learn them, must learn to be good at them, and that's going to be your life's career. You know, you can be a stockbroker on the side, but you're going to be a parameterer. You know, you're going to be a perfectionist for the rest of your life, okay? That's your real career, is to follow these six things and to learn to perfect them. Learn all the tricks, learn all the details of them, okay? He gets into one last point. He says, are the perfections mental or do they depend on some outer perfection? He gives the example of giving, okay? When you perfect giving, does it imply that every sentient being in the world is no longer poor? You know, like, does perfection of giving mean that you give away money to everyone you meet? In other words, have I perfected giving if one person around me still is broke? I mean, do I have to go and physically make sure that every person I know is not poor before I can say that my giving is perfected? And it's a big question. No. Okay? Why? Plenty of Buddhas around, and plenty of broke people around, I can pledge, you know, I can attest to it. So they did perfect giving, and there's still people around who need money. So it doesn't mean that the perfection of giving is that every person around you is not broke anymore. It's the state of mind that is totally willing to give up everything you have, body, possessions, and your goodness to other people. You know, it's that state of mind. It's the perfection of that state of mind. Now we have to study Madhyamika. It's very common for the mind to go from here to here. This state of mind says, the perfection of giving, if I get perfect at it, then everybody around me will have everything they need. That's not true. Okay? That's not the perfection of giving. It's the willingness to give them anything you have, immediately, without any hesitation. Everything. Okay, then the mind, the human mind goes from there over to here. Hey, then I can sit at home and think about giving, you know? Because Michael Roach got up there, he said, perfection of giving I can do in the comfort of my own home, you know? And you have to prevent that extreme also. You're not a bodhisattva if you have anything that you could give and you're just sitting at home thinking about it. Okay, that's not the point. I mean, the perfection of giving, it is true, is only a state of mind. You can reach the perfection of giving and everybody around you can be dead broke, but you better not have any money, okay? What it means is, obviously it should be expressing itself in your behavior. To say, I perfected giving, and you still have something to give other people that would help them, then it's just BS, right? So perfection of giving is a mental state, but if it's not manifesting itself in your activities, then come on. You know, are we supposed to believe that? You know, you have something, they need it. Let's get going. You know, you have it, you give it to them. I was with Rinpoche, we saw the Pope on TV in Giant Stadium. And he got up and said, don't give people your extra. Give them your capital. And Rinpoche was, that's great. You know, don't give them your excess, you know. Give them what they need. Give them what you have. And if you don't, then don't say you're at home perfecting giving in your mind. You know, it is a mental perfection, but it should display itself automatically. How about the perfection of, what's the second one? Yeah, let's say killing. Okay, not killing. So if someone around you is getting killed, you know, if someone in your world, if I'm standing up here and someone in Tibet is being tortured, have I not perfected morality? Is that possible? Can I be aware of someone being tortured? And then because of that, I haven't perfected ethical living. It's not true, okay? Shantideva goes through that. Master Shantideva says, it's possible that you can perfect your morality and your ethical life, and people are still being hurt in the world. You cannot stop all of it. Impossible. Because you're not the cause of it. Your mental afflictions are the cause of it, okay? You have to do everything at your disposal. Anything you can do, you must do for them. But don't think that the perfection doesn't happen until the last person is not suffering in Bosnia or something. It's not like that. There could be people being killed all around you, and you could be perfect in your own morality. Okay? So that's. But does it mean you stand around and don't do anything if you hear someone's getting hurt? No. Then you haven't perfected morality. You have to think about it. Okay? Third one is what? Yeah, last question. Is it possible, if there's one more angry person in your life, does that mean you didn't perfect patience? If there's one more irritating person in the world, does that mean that you've been a failure in the perfection of patience? No. There'll be lots of angry people. On the day that you reach nirvana, and end your anger forever, and reach the perfection of patience, total perfection, there'll be lots of people around you who are still irritating. Okay, so he says that's not the perfection of patience. It's the mental part of not getting angry ever again. Then you've perfected patience. So that's just another point in the verses. Okay, I think we covered everything. We're a little bit late, so we're gonna stop. We're gonna go straight to the prayer or something, and we'll try to finish the reading by next week. Okay. And again, be ready next week mentally. Bring nice stuff. Don't bring your excess, okay? Bring some major neat stuff, okay? Flowers. Make the place nice. Make it really nice. come a little bit early and bring something really cool. Doesn't have to be expensive, but it should be from your heart. Something from your heart.